Good afternoon. Thank you for joining us today for our briefing, Stopping the Spread of the Coronavirus, What Federal and State Governments Can Do to Increase Access to Treatment and Prevention. I am Rachel Newsom, Vice President for Federal and State Health Policy at the Commonwealth Fund. For those of you who don't know, the Commonwealth Fund is a nonpartisan health policy research foundation aimed at creating a high-performing U.S. health system. The goal of today's call is to provide guidance about what can be done to ensure that all Americans can get access to the healthcare they need as we work to respond to the COVID-19 pandemic. The pandemic will impact every aspect of our health system, but we only have an hour today, and we are going to be very focused specifically on what the federal government and state governments, as well as insurers, can do to help stop the coronavirus spread and assure those who need testing and care can get it. What we know about the pandemic changes daily, and with it, the policy environment. With activity underway in Congress, in the administration, and in states all across the country, the policy landscape will continue to evolve. Today, we will share insights and options available as of March 17, 2020. We plan to continue to address other health policy-related aspects of the coronavirus, such as the capacity of the U.S. healthcare system to deal with the crisis, in future briefings. We look forward to your suggestions on future areas of focus. All of the fund's COVID-19 resources can be found on our website and will be updated regularly. I'm pleased to be joined today by my colleague, Sarah Collins, Vice President for the Commonwealth Fund's Program on Healthcare Coverage and Access, as well as Sarah Rosenbaum of the George Washington University's Milken Institute of Public Health, and Kevin Lucia and Joan Volk of Georgetown University's Center on Health Insurance Reform. Sarah Collins will provide some brief context on where the United States stands right now in terms of healthcare coverage and access. As a reminder, we will take questions after remarks, but you can enter the queue now for questions by pressing star one. And with that, we'll turn it over to Sarah Collins.
Thank you, Rachel. The rapid spread of the coronavirus in the U.S. is exposing several weaknesses in our health system that will compromise our ability both to mitigate spread and provide needed care to everyone who needs it. One of those unique weaknesses, and which is the focus of our conversation with you today, is that millions of people in the U.S. lack comprehensive health insurance, which sets us apart from other countries who are currently coping with the pandemic. There are two major sources of coverage weaknesses: people who are uninsured, and those who are insured but have health plans that leave them underinsured. I'm going to quickly run through a few data points that are relevant to our conversation. First, uninsurance. There are about 30 million people who are currently uninsured. Of those 30 million people, about one quarter are either eligible for subsidized coverage through the marketplaces, 15% are eligible for Medicaid or the Children's Health Insurance Program, 12% are living in one of the 14 states that haven't yet expanded Medicaid, 30% are eligible for either employer or other private coverage, and 20% are undocumented immigrants. In terms of demographics, uninsured working-age adults are disproportionately low-income, Latino, and under age 35. In terms of those at highest risk for severe illness from coronavirus, 9.4% of adults ages 50 to 64 are uninsured, which translates into about 5.8 million people. Second, underinsurance. The number of working-age adults who are insured but who are underinsured has climbed to an estimated 44 million people. This is a measure developed by the Commonwealth Fund and includes people who have high out-of-pocket costs or deductibles relative to their incomes. People in the individual market are underinsured at the highest rates. 2 of 5 adults in individual market plans are underinsured. The biggest growth in underinsurance is occurring among people who have coverage through an employer plan, which is the majority of the insured population. More than one quarter, 28% of those in employer plans are underinsured. Why does this matter? Research shows that people who are uninsured or underinsured are highly likely not to get care, even when they need it, because of the cost. With so many people uninsured or underinsured, the concern is they will not have the financial means to get tested if it costs something, or get health care if they fall sick. This weakness in our system will contribute to spread of the virus, unequal access to health care when it's needed, and hospitals with increasing financial burden from very sick, uninsured patients. Thank you, and I'll turn this back over to Rachel.
Thank you, Sarah. We're now going to turn to Sarah Rosenbaum to discuss the federal response.
Hi, everybody. I'm happy to be here this morning, although the circumstances are a little grim for us all. Hopefully everybody is doing okay out there. I'm going to quickly run through the bill that passed the House last night. It was sort of the second time through. There were some technical fixes to the first round, and I'm going to focus on the Medicaid provisions and then also mention one item that was included in last week's first supplemental. So the Medicaid provisions are designed to sort of give added strength to a program that really has been our biggest public health first responder for decades now. It is, of course, a huge public insurance program. It's got a lot of flexibility. It doesn't operate under the constraints that commercial insurance does, things like open enrollment periods and adverse selection. It's meant to absorb a lot of risk, health risks and financial risks. That's where Medicaid shines. And so once again, everybody's turning to Medicaid to sort of pick up during this terrible crisis that we're all going through at this point. So the administration, of course, inherently has a lot of power in terms of adopting liberal policies, using waiver authorities. They're now using 1135 to give states some running room in terms of the kinds of things they can do to speed up payment to providers that normally would not be so flexible in under normal circumstances. There's also separate 1115 authority, the special federal demonstration authority that would allow the administration to broaden, allow states to actually broaden Medicaid to insure people who aren't insured otherwise for conditions related to the coronavirus testing, treatment, recovery. But meanwhile, Congress has also stepped in a couple of ways. One is to add mandatory coverage of virus testing what is called testing-related services. It's a little bit ambiguous at this point for anybody who's eligible for Medicaid today without any cost sharing. And the other is to create a new state eligibility option. It's very narrow, but it's also very precedent-setting that would allow states with complete federal funding for both their medical assistance and related administrative costs to extend Medicaid to any individual who's uninsured. Any individual who's uninsured, as this is defined, as anybody who is not eligible for what is called federal health care programs, Medicare, VA, programs like that, or who's not insured, and not insured in this context includes people who may have only short-term limited duration insurance coverage. I'll let Kevin Lucia talk more about that. The federal funding would be complete. It would begin and span the period of declared emergency and would end on the last day of the quarter in which the emergency ends. So there are a number of questions that come up, which we'll be watching assuming this passes and the administration begins implementation. One is whether retroactive eligibility will, in fact, be available since the new option doesn't begin until the date of enactment, but the retroactive eligibility provision of Medicaid gives you basically a three-month look-back period. Another is what to do about the tail. There may be tests that are run after the period of declared emergency is over. Does coverage stop abruptly, or will there be some sort of a tail for tests related to the emergency itself? What happens with out-of-network coverage for beneficiaries who are current beneficiaries and in Medicaid managed care plans? What if they can't get an in-network test? Can they go to any hospital or any clinic, community clinic, and get the test done if the tests are available? What is a COVID testing-related service? Who are the uninsured? I mean, the legislation seems to be pretty clear that the uninsured is any person who needs these services and who doesn't have insurance. So do other limitations on eligibility get waived for this new population? And what will be the precise parameters of the 100% FMAP rule, and how will states be able to demonstrate, quote unquote, to the satisfaction of the secretary, which is what the legislation says, that administrative costs are in fact related to implementing the new insurance coverage group. So those are some of the immediate questions that come to mind, and let me stop here. One other thing before I stop, and that is community health centers. Community health centers got $100 million in funding last week in the separate stimulus bill. I have been told that federal guidance from HRSA will probably be out by the end of this week, so we will know how this money is going to flow to health centers. Just to remind everybody that during the 2009 economic stimulus supplemental to community health centers, HRSA figured out the fastest way possible to get the money out the door. They didn't have to start applying for funds. It sort of flowed automatically to federally funded health centers, so hopefully they'll do that here, since these guys are crucial in underserved rural and urban communities. Now I'll stop.
Great. Thanks so much, Sarah. I'll now turn to Kevin Lucia and Joanne Volk for a discussion of the state response, with the final reminder that if you want to enter the queue for questions, you can press star one. Kevin?
Oh, great. Thanks. And thanks for including me in the conversation today, the discussion today. So jumping right into private health insurance, so far congressional action hasn't addressed coverage-related requirements such as access to tests or treatment or high medical costs for those who are affected. As Sarah mentioned, the House recently passed legislation with bipartisan support to address some, though not all, of these concerns, which I'll touch on a little bit more as it relates to private health insurance. In the meantime, the Trump administration has issued a series of statements and guidance documents to try to reassure the public that corona-related needs should be covered by private insurers. This includes guidance noting that private insurers should, although with caveats, cover coronavirus medical services as an essential health benefit under the Affordable Care Act. It's worth noting that there's nothing new in this guidance. The ACA's EHB requirement has always included hospitalization, emergency services, and laboratory services as essential benefits, meaning that plans that must meet EHB would likely already cover a test to detect coronavirus and treatment if needed. That said, the law's EHB requirement applies only to the individual market policies and to small employer plans. The law does not require large or self-funded employer plans to cover EHBs, which is how most Americans are insured. It is important to note that most employer-based plans offer comprehensive coverage, that it should basically include many, if not all, of the services needed to test and treat coronavirus. But just because a service is covered benefit doesn't mean that consumers won't face high out-of-pocket costs. As of right now, the average annual deductible for a single employee in an employer plan is more than $1,800, and the average deductible for an individual market bronze level plan is more than $6,500. Some people could face hundreds or even thousands of dollars in out-of-pocket costs if they go to an emergency room, urgent care clinic, or doctor's office for testing. Out-of-pocket costs could jump significantly if they are diagnosed with the virus and require treatment. The same for those that are treated by an out-of-network provider when being tested or during subsequent treatments. Fortunately, the ACA caps total annual out-of-pocket costs for all non-grandfathered health insurance coverage. For 2020, this cap was $8,150 for individuals and $1,600 for a family. But these are still very large amounts of money, which many people do not have in savings. The ACA also provides cost-sharing relief for some marketplace enrollees, specifically those under 250% of poverty. I want to emphasize, though, that these protections that I've talked about so far only apply to comprehensive coverage options. We know that there are many people enrolled in plans that do not comply with the ACA, such as short-term health plans, which have been promoted by the Trump administration as alternatives to ACA coverage. There's millions of people covered under these types of plans. These plans don't have to cover EHB. They can deny or refuse to renew coverage for pre-existing conditions. So if you get the virus, they don't have to cover you, and they don't have to renew it. They can cancel coverage altogether. There's no protection against rescissions. And often they have very high deductibles. Individuals in short-term plans and other products that don't meet the ACA minimum standards, such as healthcare sharing ministry plans, may face pre-existing condition exclusion periods, coverage denials, skimpy benefits, and financial caps on coverage. Individuals enrolled in one of these policies who are worried about healthcare costs may, and this is the fair, delay or forgo testing and treatment, potentially increasing the virus's spread. Beyond some of the information outlined in fact sheets released by CMS last Friday, the IRS did clarify that high deductible health plans can pay for coronavirus-related testing and treatment without jeopardizing their status. This also means that an individual with a high deductible health plan that covers these costs may continue to contribute to an HSA, a health savings account. Hopefully, the federal government will continue to look for other opportunities for regulatory action to ensure that those with private health coverage have access to testing and treatment with as little exposure to cost as possible. So what does the House legislation do on the private side? As I mentioned, the House passed bipartisan legislation on Saturday that addressed a number. It was updated, as Sarah mentioned, a number of areas, including paid sick and family leave and additional funding, but also touches on coverage and testing and diagnostics for coronavirus. This is a really nice summary for anybody who's looking at it in Health Affairs that was put out by Katie Keith, and I think it's worth looking at. It requires all comprehensive private insurance plans, including employer plans and even grandfathered plans, to cover FDA-approved testing needed to detect or diagnose coronavirus, the administration of that testing, and any service or items provided during a visit to the doctor's office, an urgent care center, emergency room center, and in this new revision telemedicine visit that results in coronavirus testing or screening. Under the legislation, and similar to how certain preventive services are currently covered under the ACA, insurers would cover these services without cost sharing, meaning that patients wouldn't pay out-of-pocket costs, co-pays, deductibles, or other coverage barriers such as prior authorization requirements. There's some interesting timing issues with the bill, however. First, the coverage requirement would only kick in after the bill is enacted. So those who already have received coronavirus tests are not necessarily covered without cost sharing, unless their state, insurer, and employer has adopted a similar policy. Second, the requirement is temporary. The coverage requirement extends only while there's a declared public health emergency, as Sarah mentioned. Once HHS's declaration of a public health emergency is over, coverage without cost sharing appears to be no longer be required. I just also, too, want to flag some issues. The House legislation raises other significant questions as well. The bill itself is focused on testing and testing-related services, such as, you know, at an office or an ER visit. But the bill provides no guidance on treatment or coverage of a potential vaccine. In addition, the bill does not ban or otherwise appear to shield consumers from the possibility of surprise medical bills from out-of-network providers that they, you know, come into contact during testing, such as labs or anybody else that's pulled in during an emergency room visit. And this is a big deal. Surprise billing can be very, very expensive. So what are the states doing? Most but not all states have stepped up to help reduce or encourage the reduction of financial barriers for privately insured people to get needed medical care in relationship to the virus. And so, with support from the Commonwealth Fund, Georgetown has been monitoring state action pretty closely, with updates available through a dedicated resource on the fund's website, We're going to make sure that that link is available to everybody on the call, and we're updating it on a daily basis. New York was the first to announce emergency rules on March 2nd, prohibiting private insurance companies from imposing cost sharing on enrollees when they visit a doctor's office, urgent care center, or emergency room to seek virus testing. In addition, the regulations that they issue will ensure or encourage coverage of other services related to the treatment of coronavirus, such as future vaccine, telehealth, access to needed off-formulary drugs, and protection from surprise bills. It's important to note, though, that New York is one of the few states that have actual protections from surprise bills in statute as of right now, so they were able to quickly lead on that to protect residents of New York. Within hours of New York's announcement, Washington Insurance Department issued a similar emergency directive requiring both ACA compliance and short-term plans to cover coronavirus testing before any deductible is met. This is really important. New York, Washington recognized that these short-term plans have serious limitations that could put enrollees at risk or fear of showing up at the hospital because of they wouldn't, you know, necessarily get covered or face high cost sharing or even surprise billing, and so they included their protections in their directive. Several more states have also used directives to mandate expanded coverage, including states like Alaska, California, Colorado, Maryland, Nevada. There's more on board in each and every day. Many of these states are requiring issuers to waive enrollee cost sharing for testing services, as well as require coverage of other services such as a vaccine if developed. Early prescription drug refills is another common place that states have weighed in and making sure that telehealth is covered, but not just covered, but also covered in a robust way, or urging issuers to cover it in a robust way. I do want to point out that Massachusetts and New Mexico have instructed their issuers to cover testing and treatment without cost sharing. New Mexico also requires coverage of pneumonia and influenza in the same way. Many of these states that are acting boldly are under a governor's emergency declaration or directive. I do want to point out Vermont's Department of Insurance appears to be relying on a state statute defining healthcare as a public good. I would note that there's many state insurance codes that have language that may be able to be leveraged by their Department of Insurance. Oregon's Insurance Department took a somewhat different approach, convening selected issuers and brokering a voluntary agreement to waive cost sharing for testing services and a future vaccine. Still, other state insurance departments are encouraging issuers to cover related costs, but they're not requiring them to do so. Given the number of states that have issued emergency declarations, even in the last couple of days, there's probably going to be many more states that come on board and start really requiring their issuers to come and cover these services. Last but not least, the health insurance marketplaces in Washington, Massachusetts, Maryland, Rhode Island, New York have opened up a limited time special enrollment period for people who lack health insurance. States that use healthcare.gov do not have this flexibility, and the Trump administration has not taken a similar action. Even though state officials in these FFM states have urged them to do so. I would just say, you know, state officials appear to be showing a tremendous amount of leadership in addressing the crisis and leveraging all that they have in many states on the issuers that they can regulate. However, when it comes to private insurance, the impact of their action is unfortunately limited. States only have the power to regulate fully insured individual and group health plans. Under federal law, they can't impose requirements on self-funded employer health plans, which is more than 60% of people with employer-based coverage, and that's how they're insured. So it's really looking at the federal government to step in. And so why don't I just close it out there and hand it back to Rachel.
Thank you so much, Kevin. That was really helpful. I did want to make a clarifying statement for folks. We've been pretty good at limiting our use of acronyms, but just so folks know, because this is an important one, the FMAP acronym that we've been referring to is the Federal Medical Assistance Percentage, and it's basically the percentage that the federal government is paying states to contribute to Medicaid program expenses. So FMAP is the federal contribution to the Medicaid program. So thank you for that clarification. It is now time for us to turn to questions. Again, press star one if you would like to ask a question and be entered into the queue.
At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touch-tone phone. You may withdraw your question at any time by pressing the pound key. Once again, to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touch-tone phone. And we'll go ahead and take our first question from Daniel Chang with Miami Herald. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you for taking my question. My question is, it might be more for Sarah, but it's regarding the 1135 waiver approval that Florida received. I believe it's the first state to have received this waiver approval after the president declared an emergency on the 13th. And I'm curious, what flexibilities will this give Florida to help it respond to the crisis, and where does it fall short, if at all?
Hi.
Thank you so much. Sarah Rosenbaum, will you start us off?
Sure. Sorry. Thank you for the question. I literally just downloaded the 1135 letter to Florida, so I can't answer the question yet in detail. I'm happy to follow up with you later. But basically, the key to 1135 is bringing more providers on, getting providers paid faster, changing payment methods, doing the things that have to do with making sure that providers have the revenue they need to do the job that they're being asked to do on in this emergency. But I can follow up with you separately later on if you'd like.
Okay, yes, I would like that. Thank you.
Okay.
And we'll go next to Yujung Cho with Voice of America. Please go ahead. Your line is open. Yujung, your line is open. Please check your mute function. And looks like we'll go next to Karen Buford with the Detroit News. Please go ahead. Your line is open. Karen, please check your mute function. Your line is open.
Can you hear me? Hello?
We can. Go ahead, Karen. Thank you.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Sorry. So my question was about states that waive the employee cost sharing for COVID-19 testing and treatment. So let me ask if all states have this ability, or if there are some states that don't have this ability. And in those cases, do the employers just have to pick up the cost of these services? Just wondering how that works. And also, if all states don't have this authority, which states do not?
Thanks, Karen. Kevin, can you start us off on that?
Yeah, of course. Great question. So states, I think it's important to start out with that, you know, states only can regulate fully insured plans. So, they can regulate the insurance companies that offer these plans. And what some states have done is basically required those plans to offer testing without cost sharing. However, it doesn't extend into your self-funded plans, which are only regulated under federal law. I think that the states that have acted, you know, have so far done so under a directive that is related to their emergency powers. But as I mentioned, there are probably ways that states, most states, could look into their code and try to find a legal hook that would allow them to, you know, take a similar action. But probably not all states have that authority, and I do not I have not studied like the ability of states to act. What authority they have under any emergency powers that they may have. I would say that the states that have done this so far for the fully insured market have done so under an emergency directive of some sort, and more states have in the last days come on with these emergency directives, and so I'm expecting more states to have similar requirements for their fully insured plans. But I do really want to stress that this only impacts their fully insured market, and most people who get their coverage, or you know, up to 60% get their coverage from employer-sponsored coverage, do so under plans that are exclusively regulated under the federal government, and that's why it's really critical for Congress to step up and help provide some relief, and that's what's in the House proposal.
Okay, do you happen to know if most of the really really large employers like the are self-insured plans?
I'm sorry, you were cut off right at the end, but...
Okay, yeah, my reception is a little poor, too. Do you happen to know if most of the really large companies, like the auto companies, are self-insured plans?
Yeah, most of your large employers are self-insured plans. I think that's safe to say.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
And we'll go next to Joseph Burns with Association of Healthcare Journalists. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you for taking my question, and thanks for having this webinar today. It's terrific information. I have a couple of questions for Kevin. Kevin, can you talk a little bit about the HSA, the people who have high deductible plans? It seemed to me that you said that they can use their high deductible plans to pay for testing. Did I miss something there? Because, of course, they do. But do they get that money back, or is it lost to them as it would be? And how does it link to an HSA? So that's my first question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, what we do know is the IRS clarified that high deductible health plans can pay for coronavirus-related testing and treatment without jeopardizing their status. And that does allow individuals with a high deductible health plan that covers these costs, they can continue to contribute to the health HSA. There was a question whether if a plan paid for testing, whether that somehow would jeopardize its status as a high deductible health plan. Does that help answer your question?
Yeah, I see. It would jeopardize its status. I get that. Okay.
Yeah, it was really a status question because plans, you know, as I understand it, and Joanne Volk, who's on the call too, might be able to weigh in here. But if a plan is paying out costs before the deductible is met, there was a question on whether that plan would lose its status under evaluation by the IRS. And I think they took the step, you know, recognizing that they want plans. I mean, there's an interest in having plans allow access to the testing services without cost sharing. But it's testing and treatment. That's how the guidance was written out. And if it's helpful to you, I'm happy to send that guidance to you, and we can set up another call and walk through it if you want to. Joanne, I don't know if you have anything to add there.
No, that's essentially it, so that you can still get services before the deductible without losing eligibility to use that plan with your HSA.
Okay, so you can get services without – okay, great. That explains it. Thank you. There was a question that came up yesterday. One of my colleagues heard that some utilities were going to waive payments, you know, for heat and electricity for those who are unemployed, and she asked me if the marketplace insurers would do the same for premiums for those who are unemployed or, you know, can't afford the premiums. Is there any I looked in the Health Affairs article by Katie Keith that you mentioned, Kevin, but I didn't see any, you know, I just looked at it quickly and did a quick search. So I apologize for not reading it fully. But
No. It's a great question. So open enrollment is done, but there are a number of SPMs, which we have links to in this piece that we're kind of updating for the Commonwealth Fund that is going to allow people to kind of specially enroll into marketplace coverage. And I think it's important for everybody on the call to understand that there are premium assistance for people under 400% of poverty that are going into the marketplace. And for those that are under 250% of poverty, they have access to plans that have limited cost sharing. So there's premium assistance for people. And for our lower income enrollees, there's also assistance on the cost sharing side. So the issue right now, though, that I think is important to recognize is that not every state-based marketplace has opened up a special enrollment period, and even though a number of states have kind of called on the Trump administration to open up a special enrollment into the FFM, which kind of runs the marketplace for many, many states, they have not done that yet.
Kevin, this is Joanne. Can I add about the grace period, though, for people? If you're a marketplace enrollee who has premium tax credits to help pay your premiums, you qualify for a 90-day grace period without paying premiums. As long as you pay your premiums before the 90 days is up, you can retain coverage as long as you've paid that first premium that makes your coverage effective. So at least for those with premium tax credits, there's a 90-day grace period built into the law.
Okay, great. Thank you.
And this is Sarah Collins. And Sarah Rosenbaum can jump in too. I also just want to remind people too that if you're in a state that's expanded eligibility for Medicaid, if your income's under 138% of poverty, which is about 17,000 for an individual and 35,000 for a family of four, then you're eligible for Medicaid. And there are no special enrollment periods. You can just get covered. So that's a key key thing for people to know too.
This is Sarah Rosenbaum. There's no special enrollment periods. Most Medicaid programs, it's actually a requirement of the law, have enrollment right at healthcare facilities, at hospitals, every community health center in every community out there does Medicaid enrollment. And there's no barrier to Medicaid if, let's say, you have very limited coverage under a different plan, like a short-term limited duration plan. You can enroll in Medicaid. Medicaid does not have what's called a crowd-out provision. You can be dually covered, actually. So people really with low income should be looking to their states to see if there are an expansion state and if they and then go online to the Medicaid program.
Well, that's great. Thank you.
And we'll go next to Abigail Abrams with Time Magazine. Your line is open.
Thanks so much for doing this call. You all talked before about questions about whether cost sharing waived in the House bill would be retroactive or apply after the emergency. I'm curious if there's a sense of how that would work logistically if the bill goes through. Do we know, you know, whether what that would look like for patients if they get tested, then where they send their bills, or how complicated that would be to put that in place?
Sarah Rosenbaum, do you want to start?
This is Sarah Rosenbaum. On the waiver of cost sharing?
Right, for testing.
Your question sort of, it broke up for some reason at my end. So the question is, how complicated is it to put waiver of cost sharing protections in place? States are very fast at doing things like this because there are a lot of kinds of Medicaid services for which no cost sharing can be imposed. And so providers are told, you know, this is what you can, this is what you cannot ask for cost sharing on. And because of the emergency here, I can't imagine that providers are going to be confused about what is a coronavirus-related visit and a test. That's one of the key things, though, that we need the definitions from CMS on, because the statute is, as amended by the legislation, is relatively broad. And so I'm sure CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which oversees actually both Medicaid and Medicare and CHIP, which all have amendments as well, and of course is involved in the private insurance market to some degree, they will be getting a lot of clarifying amendments out, which we will be watching very closely. And states are really on top of instructing providers what they can and cannot impose a copay for. That's not to say it can't happen, but providers generally would, you know, be looking for guidance from the states about whether cost sharing is waived.
Great. Thank you.
And we'll go next to Wu Zheng Cho with Voice of America. Your line is open.
Hi, this is Wu Zheng Cho with the Voice of America. Thank you for doing this. Many states announced coronavirus measures, especially the couple days. Based on those measures, what do you think they are learning from other countries who already had a surge in coronavirus? Thank you.
Sarah Collins, do you want to start with some state-level data that we have?
Sure. I guess just out of just in terms of state vulnerability, the states that at least and just focusing the question on the what we're focused on right now, which is the coverage area, I think that the state response that Kevin went through, at least in the private market, indicates that the coverage part is so important in terms of making it easier for people to get tested if they need to. So in that sense, the learning is happening from other countries, and then surely the federal response with the House bill is trying to do the same thing in a more national way. But I think there are significant gaps across the country, and we know that states that haven't expanded the Medicaid programs, like the state of Florida, for example, which has a very large population, a very large number of people who are uninsured, and would need really to address that issue in their own state. But maybe some of the other Sarah and Kevin would like to jump in on that too.
This is Sarah Rosenbaum. I really don't have anything to add on this point.
Yeah, no, me neither. The only thing I would say is that, you know, cost sharing is copays, deductibles. I mean, they're in place to slow people down from getting unnecessary care. But unfortunately, you know, I think they also get in the way of people getting the care that they really need. And that's well documented in the literature. And so here's a situation where we know people need to freely and comfortably go and get services, especially for testing and when a vaccine becomes available. But are they going to, or treatment, but are they going to do it if they know they're going to get whacked with, thousands of dollars in cost sharing, and potentially even more when you think about if they get hit with balanced billing? And so, I just want to, I think it's unique to our, system, and it's an unfortunate part.
Sarah, this is Sarah Rosenbaum. One other thing to note, which is for people who live near a safety net provider like a community health center, in the absence of first of all, they're very involved. Well, the hospitals and health centers are very involved with the testing in their communities at this point as the test kits are becoming available. Cost sharing is adjusted on a sliding fee basis, and for Medicare beneficiaries who don't have supplemental coverage through Medicaid or otherwise, cost sharing is actually not allowed. The priority of getting the test should outweigh anything. And if you're near a safety net, a public hospital or a health center, these are the providers that are doing their utmost to try and, you know, eliminate the access barriers.
I cannot change it. I cannot change it. Even if you cry, I cannot change it. Go. That's your father. Eskin is your father.
And as a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, that is star and one on your touch-tone phone. And we'll go next to Michael Miller with Community Catalyst. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks so much. I have a question for Sarah and a question for Kevin. And my question for Sarah is about Medicaid and providing treatment without cost sharing, which I was, when I read the congressional language, it looked to me like the FMAP, increased FMAP provisions actually were contingent on states covering not only testing, but also treatment without cost sharing. But perhaps I didn't read that right, so I was wondering if you could comment on that. And for Kevin, my question was, do you know if any state has gone the route of regulating providers as opposed to regulating health plans? Because state regulatory authority with providers is really pretty broad and actually would extend to providers who are providing care to self-insured beneficiaries. So those are my questions. Thanks.
This is Sarah Rosenbaum. Thank you. I think what you may be referring to is the maintenance of effort requirement. So this bill, the bill that passed the House, would do the same thing that other bills to help states respond to emergencies through increased federal Medicaid funding do, which is to say we'll give you the increased federal funding. And I should note it's not just federal Medicaid funding for medical care costs, which is known as the FMAP, thank you to Rachel for clarifying that before. It's also federal financing for the administration costs, which is a separate, known as FFP provision. So states can actually get the 100% for both their medical assistance and potentially administration costs that can be justified. But in exchange for that, they have to agree to certain maintenance of effort obligations. And I think what you may be referring to is that during the period when you're drawing down this extra money, you can't tighten up your eligibility rules, basically. You can't hike up your premiums. You can't impose financial obligations on existing beneficiaries that you didn't impose before. The expanded coverage for uninsured patients right now is only for the testing. There is legislation being drafted for introduction, I believe, on the Senate side that would add an additional state option to get federal funding at the enhanced rate just for treatment, for treatment as well as the testing. But that's still very much a work in progress. So essentially, and you're quite right to flag this, and it's something else to pay attention to as CMS writes the implementing guidelines, which is how do they articulate the maintenance of effort requirements. But it's not so much a bar to cost sharing in treatment as much as it is you can't start changing state plan, what's called standards and methodologies, which is the statutory language for eligibility rules, And you can't hike premiums beyond where they might have been in January 2020. And you can't impose cost sharing for testing. And there is some reference to treatment and to vaccines. So whether they bar all cost sharing for testing and treatment, whether they just simply don't allow any alterations of the rules, not totally clear yet.
Thank you.
Yeah, and Michael, thanks for that question on rider billing, and that's what I assume you're asking. But yeah, you're right, states have broad authority over providers and their billing practices, which they can do, in isolation of the issuers. It seems to me that you probably have to take a, you want to be touching the issuers and the providers simultaneously. Make sure that the designs are working for consumers, while at the same time that the payment that that issuers are paying providers are coming out at a spot that makes sense and continues to, support providers doing the work that they need to do. But yeah, you're right that a state has broad authority over providers and provider billing practices, and that could be a road that they may want to explore. And I guess, like, in general, and I'm not aware of any state that has taken that step in reaction to this crisis. But I think it's important for both at the federal level and at the state level to continue to think about all of their authority and the flexibility that they have with their authority. And this is not a time to be kind of stingy with their authority and their flexibility, to make sure that the system of health coverage on the private side is working for consumers and enrollees when they really are, desperate to figure out how they can navigate this system, to get testing and potentially a vaccine and treatment and avoid, some of these major potential cost-sharing concerns.
And as a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, that is star and one on your touch tone phone. And we'll go next to Harris Meyer with Modern Healthcare. Your line is open.
Yeah, hi, folks. Sorry, I'm late coming in. And if this question's already been asked and answered, then just tell me. Joan Elker raised the question about whether states that have premiums and retrospective eligibility waivers, et cetera, should be moving to eliminate those during this crisis. Are you hearing any moves in that direction? Has that question already been asked?
This is Sarah Rosenbaum. I don't think that question has specifically been asked, but the short answer is yes. I mean, from my perspective, any limitation on eligibility or coverage right now that is authorized under a demonstration, although the language of the maintenance of effort provision may in fact say that even if you're operating under a demonstration authority, you can't get the enhanced funding for new populations and keep those restrictions in place. So the interaction between 1115 demos and maintenance of effort is a whole subspecies of maintenance of effort questions, but certainly putting aside whether you're going to expand to cover the uninsured or pick up the additional FMAP, as a state, you want to try and ease access at this point.
Okay, thanks. I just wanted to say, have you heard any states that, whether it's Indiana or others, that are actually considering or moving to do that?
This is Sarah Rosenbaum again. I have not.
Okay.
It appears we have no further questions in queue at this time.
Great. Thank you so much all for joining us today. This has been recorded and will be available along with the other COVID-19 related resources on the Commonwealth Fund's website. If you had questions we didn't get to, please feel free to reach out to us via email. As I mentioned, we will hold additional teleconferences around our response to the COVID-19 pandemic. We look forward to suggestions on what could be most helpful. We hope this one has been useful. Thank you again, and be well.